to ESAB's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to Michelle Egan. Michelle is Professor and Jean Monnet Chair at the School of International Service at the American University. She's also associated with the Wilson Center and is a frequent voice in US and global discussions on international affairs. Her research has covered many areas, North America, Europe, transatlantic relations, among others, and what binds them together is an interest in comparative politics and political economy. She's the author of several books, including Single Markets, Economic Integration in the EU and the United States, and Constructing a European Market, Standards, Regulation, and Governance. As you can hear from these titles, Professor Egan has spent a good amount of time thinking about how large and federal markets emerge and how they are governed. And this is also what I want to talk to her about today. Michelle, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
So I want us to start with a comparison between the United States and Europe. They are both consolidated federal markets. And I wanted to ask you if you could sort of lead us off by pointing to what are the main similarities and differences between the United States and the European Union when it comes to market policies, and how do these similarities and differences manifest themselves in more specific policies?
Thank you. Absolutely. I think the first issue is how very centralized the EU is, built on this treaty framework, legal framework, and sort of a conscious effort to create a single market. If you talk to Americans about the single market, they take it as a given, even though there are still internal barriers to trade. From the perspective of similarities, I think both of them are open economies. Both of them have certain levels of things like free movement of goods, interstate commerce. We don't pay much attention to a lot of the restrictions these days, but certainly there is a higher degree of labor mobility in the United States than there is in Europe. And we talk about them as cross-jurisdictional markets. And one difference would be that the United States has much more specialized regional economies than the EU does. The second difference is the United States is much, much more an asymmetrical federal system than the EU. And I want to give you just two interesting examples. We talk about non-discrimination in trade, and you assume that all of the EU rules on the single market apply to all member states, and you can go to court if you feel there is a trade barrier. That said, within the United States, we have very different territorial units. First of all, Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, they don't have statehood. So we've got this large market where different component units are treated very differently. The vast Indian lands and Indian territories have different economic systems, different federal systems, different legal systems. You wouldn't see that in the EU. And the second difference that is the most surprising for Europeans is that the federal government owns vast amount of lands in the West. So if you live in the Western lands, you are much more subject to federal rules than if you are elsewhere. For example, 40 to 60% of land in the West might be owned by the federal government, which makes decisions on mineral rights, land rights, water rights, and all of those things. So that would be like the EU having much more intervention in Hungary or Poland than in the UK in how they structure their economies and the kind of economic activities they could do.
Indeed. And would it be right to say that, I mean, my sort of way of looking at U.S. market policies, and by U.S. market policy, I mean sort of basically commercial policy, commercial regulation, and the type of policies that govern the way the United States conducts itself vis-a-vis other countries in trade negotiations and other commercial negotiations. Would it be right to say here that we have, on the one hand, an America which intentionally has created sort of a pretty messy type of constitutional structure. And they've basically done so intentionally. They wanted to have sort of the variety, the plurality. And one of the reasons they wanted to have it is because at least some of the constitutional inspirers and fathers made the point that this is going to lead to consequences for society, for liberty, and for the economy, where no one really can amass a large amount of power. I don't know if that's the right way to look at commercial policies here, but if we take that at least view of the EU situation and compare to Europe, even if we started off with an integration policy in Europe that was largely sort of built on the notion that nation states would remain nation states, there was at least from the beginning an intention to gradually move towards some more of a federal structure. And the more we empower the federal structure with policy competence, the more that structure would also largely have powers which would be more similar to a national state rather than to a federal state. Would you agree with that characterization?
Yes. It's much more messy in the United States. And from that point of view, some of the competences that we think about that are federalized in the EU have evolved over time. You know, we're seeing that right now. We don't have a lot of competence in public health at the EU level. And so there's been criticisms of the slow response to the pandemic. That said, it's very messy in terms of competences in the US. That does have commercial implications. You know, if we ask ourselves, you know, well, why is insurance a state-level commercial activity? Why are professions a state-level commercial activity? And that creates a lot of fragmentation. But Americans also like to think about their states as incubators, as sort of innovators. And so sometimes what we also find is a policy that might emerge at the state level oftentimes becomes federalized. There's also the notion in the United States of states as kind of innovators, and, you know, things might become start at one level, like income tax, and then it becomes federalized at the national level. Or we might also find that states are using a lot of their commercial activities as competition across states or to raise revenue. You know, one example that perhaps is surprising for Europeans is that you've replicated certain commercial activities at the member state level. So some states had very, very strong competition regimes. So that kind of commercial activity has become very strong at the EU level with mergers and acquisitions, state aids and subsidies and controls in that area for a long time. And it has a legal framework. One of the interesting aspects is if you look at financial crises and what's going to happen in the US, the US has no rules on state aids and subsidies. So you have a tremendous amount of competition for manufacturing or for industry or for relocation in the United States. And you have states competing with one another through loan guarantees, depreciation allowances. The recent Amazon decision to create a second location outside of Washington State led states to throw money left, right, and center at Amazon to try and get them to relocate. And so those kind of commercial activities, what we call corporate welfare in the United States, is markedly different from the EU, which is a much more formal regulatory scrutiny framework.
And here in Europe, I mean, we are almost constantly thinking about our market as being work in progress. For the last years, we've been spending a lot of time thinking about how to expand the single market, how to build a digital single market. We have projects and ambitions on a capital union, etc. To what extent would policymakers in America consider their market to be a work in progress? And to what extent, so is there a development where you want to establish more rules that avoid situations when states compete with each other in order to attract inward FDI or new Amazon warehouses with different type of incentives? To what extent is there a drive towards federalizing more sectoral policies? Here in Europe, we are a bit annoyed sort of that many different professions, if you have a professional degree in one country, you cannot know with a high degree of certainty that you can practice in another country. But we're gradually moving there, and we're gradually trying to find systems to mutually recognize different sort of professional standards. But I understand it that in America, the development is almost going in a different direction, where states protect their markets and their professional standards even more than they did in the past. So is there sort of some degree of sort of a common view in America that they want to go towards more of a federal structure even there on these type of issues?
I think that raises three issues. The first one is that, you know, if you think about how the EU has sort of integrated its market and the policies it's chosen, you have both the harmonization approach and the mutual recognition approach as two sort of models, if you like. The uniform state legislative movement in the United States was a failure, and they were never able to have that sort of standardization. And so what they have done is they've done something that would potentially be illegal or discriminatory in the EU, and they've moved to sort of a partial mutual recognition. So you often have interstate compacts or regional options of mutual recognition that is amongst 3-4 states, 4-5 states. It might be on different issues, whether it's land, sustainable development. It might even be on mutual recognition of professions, but it doesn't necessarily cover the whole country, which would be sort of markedly different, where this, you know, fits 27, 28 states in Europe, and you have to, you know, have harmonization or mutual recognition. So that's one. In terms of actual specific policies, I think the United States is much more willing to experiment in some areas, and there's been a little bit of variation. So on the one hand, if you look at something like education, it's a local policy. They've tried to have both state education, private education, and then trying a lot of different models of charter schools and startups. There's almost a startup venture capital culture in sort of an area like that. But if you move to something like professions, which has been a very important issue in trying to liberalize in the EU single market, you will find that states have gone the other direction. Almost 1 in 4 people in the United States is subject to an accreditation, licensing, or professional certification. And it varies across states. You might have 400 and something occupations in California that are regulated. You might only have 50 in Maine. So the variation across the United States in how many occupations and professions they are regulating varies markedly. And there's been a lot of pushback on that in terms of the sense that it really impacts low-income workers who face real barriers to entry. So the same kind of barriers to entry and liberalization you're trying to do in the EU is very much on the table in the United States. And there's been an effort to sort of deregulate. Well, of course, it's a raising of revenue for states or boards or commissions. So states are very protective of those licensing and accreditation rights. That said, the pandemic has probably been the avenue to liberalize this market in the United States. The health professions have been at the forefront of realizing that if you have licensing restrictions, you can't practice across borders, that this doesn't work in a pandemic. So it's ironic that it's taken this pandemic for the United States to loosen a lot of those cross-border regulations and allow a lot of cross-border practice, cross-border mobility. And I think there's a hope that this may lead to some deregulation, if you like, at the state level.
I think we're seeing something similar in Europe as well, not so much on professional licenses. I think this has affected us a lot more when it comes to product standards, where there has been sort of a degree of differences internally in Europe on PPE, some medical equipment as well. But now during this pandemic, every government has been readily accepting the product standards of other EU countries, just assuming that if it's good for them, it's good for us. And It may be the situation that we're not going to return sort of to the old system we had before the crisis afterwards. Anyway, so I want us to move on a little bit to sort of use the discussions we have had now as a backdrop to another question I have and something I've been thinking about quite a lot over the past year. So in the trade policy world, there has been this intention to move towards what some people call modern or new generation type of trade agreements. Perhaps that's a vocabulary that we use more often in Europe than elsewhere. But the meaning of it is that we have basically achieved a lot when it comes to old trade policy. So we have reduced tariffs to the point where most of the time when tariff exists, they are so low that they don't really protect much anymore. There may be non-tariff measures that require more attention, but most of the traditional non-tariff measures that we talked about, they have largely been addressed in a way which I think make most people to sleep comfortably at night. Now we're beginning to think more about other issues. So we're going into services, we're going into domestic regulations behind the border, more sort of deeper behind the border stuff. We are talking about real or sort of direct border barriers against cross-border digital exchange and more indirect measures that exist against cross-border digital exchange. And once we begin to enter these discussions, I think we also get confronted with a problem of trade policy governance, which means that we're entering into areas where federal construct has less power to control the instruments than they used to have in the past when we were predominantly dealing with obvious trade issues like tariffs. So the question here is, sort of, is the federal structure working against the stream of trade policy development now in the sense that it makes it difficult for federal structures to go into these type of new areas?
I think it depends on the allocation of competences, what is at the federal level and what is at the subnational level. And I also think that, you know, given the legal expectations, if you sign up to a free trade agreement, that states or subnational or provinces or regions have a commitment to implement. If you sort of look at this and you think about all these new areas that states are putting on the table to negotiate, we've got these sort of tariff peaks, if you like, and we know that we are moving successfully in that area. If you think about, say, EU-Mexico, you sort of have 99% of the tariff lines in customs duties and goods have been removed, and you've got about 80% of the tariff lines in agriculture with a few exceptions. So it's not really the tariffs, you're right, it's the non-tariff barriers or behind the border issues. And this becomes a real issue in two ways. If you look at how USTR negotiates, the US Trade Representative, you know, it doesn't include states in the negotiation process. So many of the issues that the EU would like to liberalize, insurance, procurement, they're at the subnational state level and they're not put on the table. The other issue from a US perspective, if you look at the government procurement agreement, not all US states have signed up to it. So not all of them are committed to that liberalization. So if these issues are state level competences or part of the state capacity in a federal system like the US, USTR can say these are not on the table. And of course, from a European perspective, if you've got all of these state aids and subsidies, if you are not putting procurement on the table, which is 80% at the local or municipal level, or you only have selective states involved in procurement, that's really limiting the trade negotiations. The second issue, I think, is in terms of the impact that it can have. In the US perspective, if you're not going to put these issues on the table and the United States USTR says, no, they're not on the table, then it takes off a lot of the things that the EU is prioritizing in a trade agreement. But that said, if you compare that with what Canada did in the EU CETA agreement, where they brought the provinces into the equation, because a lot of the issues at the provincial level in terms of a wide range of commercial transactions in business, securities, a lot of things, property and civil rights, were at the provincial level in Canada, then bringing the provinces to the table allowed sort of a more open discussion about opening market access to some provincial competences. So there's a real contrast between how the United States brings in states versus how Canada brought in provinces. And that can have an impact on these behind the border issues. That said, I think it's also a matter of structure. You mentioned product standards, and I think a lot of this goes back to a very different set of perceptions that I don't think the US and EU are ever going to overcome. You know, the United States has a plurality of trade associations that set product standards, and oftentimes the federal government will incorporate them into legislation. So if you want to access that market, you have effectively locked in certain US trade association standards if you want to access that market. And the Europeans have very much centralized it, created sort of European standards bodies that produce a European-wide standard. And so you have one model where there's a plurality of different groups, different trade associations setting standards in different sectors. And then you have a European model where it's one European standard fits the whole market. Now, that's not saying either model is better than the other, but just having those two models and then sort of saying, well, we want mutual recognition, mutual access, is very difficult because the starting point of how you set standards is very, very different.
Indeed. And if we take, for instance, CETA as an example, so we had an interesting model when it came to the negotiations, in the sense that Canadian provinces had to be involved in the practical negotiations because, partly for constitutional reasons and partly also for political reasons, there were less developments like that on European side, even if we on the European side can sort of make the point, well, you know, most governments need to buy in on the negotiation mandate, and they will be regularly consulted even if they don't participate in the actual negotiations of things. So there will be a component of participation sort of at a sub-federal level here. But then in Europe, it went a step further because of an interpretation of the legal structure for trade policy in Europe when it comes to basically governments giving the assent to the trade deals that are negotiated by the European Union. And we ended up in a situation where also regional parliaments had to make the decisions about whether they could support the trade agreements that had been negotiated. And that became sort of a almost toxic political situation that involved, at the end, so they managed to resolve some of the issues, but I think we have also opened the door to very, very complicated ratification procedures in Europe when we're going to have, in some countries, regional parliaments to participate there. I'm using that sort of as a background to ask sort of whether we can think about other approaches here. Is there, for instance, examples about states in America negotiating directly with other countries on issues that concern international commerce, either on professional standards, on government procurement, or other issues where states has a lot of power to set their own policies?
Yes and no. On the one hand, you know, legally, constitutionally, from the Supreme Court case with Massachusetts a few years ago, states are not allowed in the United States to negotiate. You know, they are subservient to the federal system. So USTR will do that. I also think that what we tend to forget is that a lot of states and governors in states tend to think about commercial activities as state promotion, economic development, trying to attract foreign direct investment rather than trade negotiations per se. And many of them don't have large trade offices at the state level. There are exceptions, Washington State, New York, and others. That said, there have been lots of instances of cross-border commercial activity and arrangements between the US and Canada. particularly sort of New York with its counterparts on procurement policies. And those agreements are sort of cross-border, a state to a province. So there is that level of commercial activity, commercial agreements that takes place. However, I think a lot of it is dependent on how much is put on the table. So for example, the USTR is not going to put state procurement on the table if it ever negotiates with the EU. So states don't really have to mobilize because the USTR has taken that off the table. And the inclusion of states in the trade negotiations are very, very marginal. There are organizations, the National Governors Association and others, that follow trade agreements, but states are treated almost the same as industry associations, and they get to put their comment on a trade agreement at the very end of the process when it's all sort of been agreed. And secondly, unlike the EU, where you had regional parliaments voting, states don't vote on the trade agreement. It's an up and down in Congress, and Trade Promotion Authority delegates the trade power to USTR. So the states are really excluded. That said, when the NAFTA-USMCA was being renegotiated, there was a real emphasis by Canadian premiers, Canadians from the provinces, to really lobby governors to support the agreement and to put pressure on Washington to support the negotiated agreement. And if we do look at Canada, there's a really interesting difference between Canada and the United States. When the United States negotiates a free trade agreement with, you know, whether it's USMCA or the potentially in the future an EU agreement, there's no real domestic structural reform. They, you know, nobody thinks about what are the domestic changes we have to make to implement this trade agreement. The contrast is with Canada. Once they started negotiating CETA with the EU, they actually realized that they were giving more market access to Europeans under the agreement than they were giving with provinces. And there were a lot of interprovincial restrictions on trade. So what they've done is they've actually adopted in 2017 a Canadian free trade agreement to try and create a common market or a single market in Canada. So they're recognizing that the barriers and provincial barriers, the within the border restrictions, cross-border restrictions, are actually hampering their overall competitiveness. So it's really interesting to see how a trade agreement with the EU has had much more markedly impact on an effort at domestic structural reform within Canada than with the United States. And certainly we're going to also see a lot of differences in what's acceptable in terms of a trade agreement. These trade agreements now, they're not the same if you look at them between, we all tend to think of them as a one size fits all. But for example, if you look at the new issues in trade agreements, the EU-Canada has an agreement on regulatory cooperation, you know, an effort to try and have reduce conformity assessment, the duplicate licensing, testing and certification. That's new, that's novel. And that's something that came out in the EU-Canadian CETA agreement. If you look at the EU-Mexico, there is trade and sustainable development. There is digital trade. There is the issue of animal welfare. There's even sort of a chapter on corruption. Some of these are non-trade issues. So we've really moved beyond a traditional trade agreement when we negotiate with the EU.
And do you think that this development will continue for large federal structures as the European Union and the United States? I'm asking that question because I've picked up over recent years sort of an underlying assumption that while large federal economies may have been powerful and been able to call the shots in many trade negotiations in the past, it's going to be much more difficult for them in the future. And people seem to point to two reasons. The first reason is that they are politically messy. They are complex constitutional constructions that will have to spend a lot of time
just getting sort of the internal support for doing things in new areas. So they become sort of slow moving. They are not agile. And the other reason is what you pointed to in what you just said, that sort of in the EU-Canada negotiations, the starting point for the EU, and it has been the starting point for a number of years now when we've taken new initiatives, is that, well, we are not going to change anything at all in our policy as a consequence of this trade agreement. The acquis will be the same. So we are not going to negotiate something with Canada, with Australia, New Zealand, America, and others that will actually force us to make a change in our policy. And then you will get, you know, governments in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and elsewhere saying, well, what's the point of the negotiations then? If you're not going to change anything and you're just going to ask us to change anything, to something in order to get a little bit better access to a large market like you, then this may not be sort of good forms of trade agreements. I've seen that argument also coming up in Geneva when we had plurilateral negotiations on services, where lots of countries was just complaining that it's impossible to get anything done if the EU, United States, and also China need to sort of find a way to get internal political agreement about liberalizing services. Nothing is going to move there. So what do you think here? Is sort of these old large federal constructs, are they doomed to become sort of slow moving and not being able to participate in a trend where perhaps other countries are going to move faster into this new type of areas where, since they can control these policies a bit more than federal constructs can do?
I think it varies on the federal system and the allocation of competences. I do think that you know, the counter argument with plurilateral would be the recent success that the Europeans have excluded the United States with its new proposals for the multilateral investment court, you know, to deal with dispute settlement issues that United States was blocking appointments at the WTO. So maybe there is a little bit of hope in that area that you can have a sort of coalition of the willing, if you like, moving forward in some areas. I wonder if we should not think about the fact that we don't have a US-EU free trade agreement, but I wonder if we never take a step back and look at all of the sectoral type agreements that have facilitated commercial activity and have facilitated sort of a transatlantic market, but without the sort of formal structure of a free trade agreement. And here are sort of just a couple of examples. We do have a mutual recognition agreement in the veterinary sphere. We do have some agreements in terms of the wine and spirits sector, or we even have sort of an arrangement on containers, which is really important commercially to stop the sort of, you know, stop gridlock, if you like. So I wonder if sort of sectoral agreements might also be the way to go to facilitate commerce in, you know, mutual recognition of professions. You see that in both NAFTA, but under USMCA to allow the free movement of business professions. So I wonder if sectoral type agreements might be easier rather than have a comprehensive one that generates a lot of backlash in particular areas. And so the second issue will be levels of consultation. Levels of consultation with both civil society, but also with subnational states and regions. And I think there is a better infrastructure in place in Canada to sort of have that intergovernmental relationship than perhaps there is in the United States. And one could argue as well in the EU context that going before the European Parliament, keeping them apprised, all of those kind of things are really beneficial in the long run in getting these large, messy federal systems to the finish line. But I also think that the other issue is to compare the trade agreements in the sense of to what extent adding a great deal of additional items beyond the traditional trade and investment ones actually has an impact domestically. It's one thing to have a trade agreement. It's another thing then to think about implementation and compliance. And we sort of forget about the trade agreements once they're signed, even if the process of ratification is messy, as it was with CETA, that we really need to pay a lot more attention to implementation and compliance. And are states doing what they say they're going to do to meet those commitments? And we pay very little attention to that in the long run. Does it really improve market access? You know, a lot of our economic models are based on certain assumptions, but it doesn't bring in the issue of implementation and compliance in the long run. Something that actually is very important in the European single market. We have something in place. If we perceive a trade barrier, we have a lot of mechanisms, not just the European Court of Justice, but we have a lot of informal mechanisms that businesses can use and channels to complain about trade barriers to try and get them resolved internally within the single market. You think of something like Solvit, and I would love to see something like some of these informal mechanisms, early warning systems used in trade agreements to really sort of avoid a lot of the trade friction.
Indeed, that's a very good idea. So now that we're talking about Europe, may I also ask you, I mean, you've been observing European commercial policies for a long time and written several books about it. How do you view the development in Europe now in light of the pandemic and the difficulties that we've seen around some trade, internal trade with medical equipment, with PPE in recent weeks and months? And I think sort of there are two different arguments in Europe right now. One argument would be that the crises have demonstrated that we need to work much more closer together, that every country would benefit from having more power centralized to the EU, where we can make policy decisions that doesn't basically leave some governments into a situation where they won't get access to important medical goods at times like this, where we could allocate resources in a much better way, leading to an outcome that would be better for every country. And then you have the pessimists on the other side that basically are going to say that, well, you know, this just proves that the frictions have become even stronger than they were in the past, and that we are almost inevitably on a trend towards not necessarily sort of disintegration, but at least a point where nothing much is going to happen because the different opinions are just too big between member states. Do you have sort of a particular view on this, or how do you sort of see the discussion developing in the next couple of months and years when Europe trying to figure out sort of what the policy consequences from the pandemic should be?
I think that what this has revealed is people are now looking at the supply chains and who is actually producing, you know, who are the big producers in these areas. I think there would be probably three responses. The first comment, slightly different, would be what's going to be the impact of the UK as being promoting services so long in the single market? What does their leaving the EU have in terms of the ambitions for services liberalization moving forward, both within the single market and also within trade agreements? The second comment that I would say is in terms of medical devices. And I think there's sort of been, you know, the first reaction is let's bring supply chains back in terms of regional supply chains closer to home. And that's been kind of one of the sort of responses. And I think that we've seen that sort of model, that sort of view articulated a little bit in some of these debates. But I also think that the other issue has been the utilization and the intersection of the economy and national security. And here in the United States, President Trump, not just during a pandemic, but even before that, has been using national security provisions to sort of promote a trade agenda. And he's used the Defense Production Act for medical devices, ventilators, and even now the meatpacking industry to keep them open. And so I see the sort of intersection now of trade and national security being very much more important in these discussions and debates. The concern that I have is that as somebody who's been looking at the development of product standards, testing, certification, the big issue down the road will be potentially liability and what happens when we're moving so fast to get ventilators, medical devices, vaccines to market. The concern has been the issue of safety. You know, Europe has been very conscious of this because of some of the problems that it's had in the past with meat standards or even breast implants. There's been a lot of concern about mutual trust and mutual testing and certification. And the concern that is not being articulated in all of this is that we know we have a demand, we know we have a need, but what will this do to certain levels of health protection and safety over the long run?
Yeah, indeed. You mentioned there initially the UK. May I just ask you, sort of, do you think that UK's departure from the EU, will it have an impact on how the EU is going to formulate its future market policies, for instance, on services, and whether we are going to go deeper integrating policies on services and perhaps digital markets more generally?
I think it's a huge loss, because if you think about where the UK was not a reluctant player in the single market, and it's been really quite significant in both digital markets, audiovisual and media, services liberalization, because obviously, you know, it's a service economy. And I think that the loss of such a large voice is going to be quite significant moving forward. And if you look at some of the proposals in terms of France and Germany, they were very heavily towards the sort of industrial policy model. And I think, you know, you're quite right in terms of going back to capital markets and so forth, is that the British are, as a financial innovator as well, that's a significant loss. And I also wonder how much the loss of Britain, you know, you've got different models, if you like, of capitalism. You've got a very much bank-based model, and then you have sort of the British model. And I wonder how much the loss of the UK will dampen some of the enthusiasm for a number of initiatives that we foresaw. That said, there is a wealth of trade history within the EU, and there is obviously the ambitions and the success in concluding a number of free trade agreements. And one has to compare that, at least in the broader geopolitical context, to the policy of the United States to pull out from a number of initiatives. So I do think that we do need to consider both the impact of the loss of the UK, given how much it's pushed a certain set of initiatives on the long-term single market. But I also think we need to think about as well the impact on the British internal market of any leaving of the EU. We don't tend to talk about the Britain as an internal market, but it is. And now if the withdrawal agreement takes place, it is actually a very much differentiated internal market, because Northern Ireland is treated differently. And the other thing I would say to conclude that is that we tend to talk about the single market not as if it's complete, but if it's a unitary single market. And I do think there are different internal markets in the EU reflecting different levels of integration. And I think part of the problem of the European single market is that it's had a sort of number of initiatives over time that have been divorced from the core function. So we talk about it as a capital markets union. We talk about it as a digital single market. And we've sort of fragmented the narrative of the single market. And secondly, I think we we treat the single market as if it's, to use Barnier's phrase, indivisible. It's not. If you look at free trade agreements, we're different in goods than we are in services in terms of our ambitions in free trade agreements. And I also think we should face the reality that the single market is very different across goods, capital, services, and labor. It's very marginal in terms of labor, but it is much more integrated in goods. So the question is what the pandemic will do to that in terms of each of these different internal markets?
That's a good question indeed. I mean, we saw already in the aftermath of the migration situation in Europe from 2015 and afterwards, when we had the erection of new border controls between countries, even between countries in Schengen. And some of those were never taken away. And one, for instance, is between Sweden and Denmark, where there is lots of people that cross the border in order to work in the other country. So it may be the case that the pandemic is going to raise new questions around that issue about cross-border labor movements. Finally, Michelle, and I ask this because we were already talking about it, and it is sort of beyond the pandemic issue, perhaps the most or the biggest challenge that the EU is facing right now with its negotiations with the UK. What do you think the UK is going to be like as an international partner after it has left the EU? Will it largely behave in the same way it has done in the past, asking for more liberalization? Or will it perhaps be a country which spends a lot more time thinking about its own internal market and trying to resolve many new problems that they perhaps weren't confronted with in the past because they dealt with it in the EU? And as a consequence, that the UK may not be sort of this outward-looking, free trade gung-ho country that at least some people in the UK thought they were going to be as a consequence of leaving the EU.
Absolutely. It's, you know, the million-dollar question, I think. But the first issue would be the domestic internal market. And that's going to be, as they've had so much discussion about, what does it mean in terms of Northern Ireland? And it's not just simply the sheer amount of cross-border traffic between Northern Ireland and Ireland on a day-to-day basis. It's going to be, you know, how do you deal with the issue that people are concerned about? If something is exported from the mainland into Northern Ireland, how do you make sure that you collect your VAT, you do customs, you do, you know, phytosanitary standards, particularly for livestock and other things? And the British government have already said very dramatically that they don't want sort of EU regional representation in Northern Ireland, which they want to put their experts there to deal with some of these. They don't want the products to go untested, unverified into the EU single market. So there are some real issues here. And the second issue will be the degree of divergence, which will occur over time. We talk about regulatory alignment. But for me, one interesting factor, and everybody's saying we want our, you know, we want certain standards or certain rules that we would like to diverge in the UK from the EU. And most people think about them in terms of labor rights or environmental. But the counterintuitive to that is that the British standards body, BSI, is basically has sort of indicated it still wants to be part of that EU standards regime. And from a business perspective, if you're going to follow as much as possible European standards, that gives you a great deal of market access. So I think that there are different dynamics going on. I think the British will be focused on, you know, what rules it wants changing vis-a-vis the EU. I think it will be looking at its own domestic market, not because of rule alignment with the EU, not always about Northern Ireland, but because Britain's an unbalanced economy. And most of the economy is around services and most of it's around London. And it, from a political perspective, Boris Johnson is in power because of Northern England, and he's going to have a really robust industrial policy and a large public budget to deal with the ramifications of the pandemic and the sort of left behind in Northern England. So from that point of view, there's a lot going on. In terms of its trade ambitions, I have always wondered why you would choose the United States first as a trade agreement and be very keen on that, especially when you are a mid-sized regional economy now outside the EU. And secondly, because you already have a robust foreign direct investment relationship. And that's going to continue without a free trade agreement. So I think that the British will be confronted with a whole host of challenges. And I think that they will, in some respects, face some of the same challenges that Mexico and Canada did. And I mean this in the following way. They're very integrated in terms of NAFTA and now USMCA with the United States. And so they had to be very, very careful when they were negotiating the new EU-Mexico agreement and the EU-Canada CETA agreement to balance the compatibility of those agreements with USMCA NAFTA. And I think that would be the analogy I would make for the UK vis-a-vis the United States and the EU.
All right. Thank you very much, Michelle. This has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for taking your time to participate.
Thank you.